So we were getting, you were telling us about how the Sense Ensemble came about, George, and we've got a video here that of some of the performance. Will we look at a few? What would you like to cover next? Would we look at some more the pictures from the actual the photographs with the vanilla scented?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's George's website there. That's georgehiggs.com. You can find out lots about George on there. And that's his SoundCloud, the new album, The Sense Ensemble. So, George, what's this here now?
So that's during the Sense Ensemble Study 2, which is, I think, the fifth track on the album. We did that in the Samuel Beckett Theater in Trinity, and it was another study whereby we taught a sequence of gestures that the piece was based on to the string quartet, the Crash Ensemble string quartet, and then to the audience, and the audience would enact these gestural syllables, whatever these patterns with us at different points. And we bring them, cue them in and out and bring them into the music. And it was scored as part of the music. And so on the album, I have a reworking of what the string quartet was playing. I actually used to play on that piano by me, which is a player piano. I think maybe I told you in the last podcast. I just kind of, as often is the case when you have a piece of music, I often noodled around with it on the piano, and I worked it into a piano piece from what was a string quartet and gestures. And then it's on the album, you'll hear it has piano, organ, drums, and bass as well, a few other things. So that's one thing I should say. Those Sense Ensemble pieces, Study 1, 2, and 3, were all originally used as studies for my PhD research into multisensory composition, but they're really reworkings of those pieces. So those pictures are of the performance, the original performance, which was this experimental performance study, which was quite different from the music, you know, that's on the album. But you know, what can you do? It's like when you film a play, it's always good to do make it a new thing. Yeah, like exactly. You're right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I think I was saying that study number one, the first time I started recording that, I was going to be pretty faithful to the original. I was like, okay, I'll put the pulsing rhythm in the beginning. I just listened to it. I was like, okay, that's interesting for me, but I don't know. So the way it starts now is like, bang, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I put something more kind of crowd pleaser-ish in there.
Right, yeah. That's important. Get their attention, you know, isn't it? Yeah.
It's funny mixing that one because I was like, it's where you pump the levels up straight up to -1 dB right away. So you're kind of stuck with that. Anyway, and then actually on the album, there are studies that I created this year. And that's why I put them on, all of them together, because I was funded by the Arts Council, luckily this year, which was great, to do some research into arts participation. And I worked with two deaf musicians, deaf individuals that I've worked with since they were 14. They're probably 26 now. And we did it through Zoom because it was COVID. It came up with gestures again.
Was that
together.
George, was that true because some of the work you do in schools, was that how that kind of came about?
I've done the work with the schools, but this was thing starting back in 2010 when I worked in St. Mary's School for Deaf Girls. So that was. And I was funded by an Artist in the Community Award to do work in St. Mary's School for Deaf Girls. And actually, there's a film of us doing a performance in the Contemporary Music Center called Machine of Song, I think I sent you earlier, Shane.
Yes.
And so I built this kind of instrument and we performed on it. It had vibrating speakers, can't get away from the vibrating speakers. It had lab and pipes, you know. It had a wooden marimba. One of the coolest things, had a cymbal on a spring, a tension spring, like from a farm. I got it from a farm cooperative shop. And so the cymbal's hanging on the spring, and you kind of you send it down to the floor, and it kind of gracefully goes down and clashes on the floor, and then springs up again, clashes on the floor again. Eventually it stops hitting the floor and just springing up and down. So it had this visual rhythm to it. It's always like happy accidents like that, which are great. You know, it's just a bit of fun.
Oh, I do a thing with Slinky and a balloon that sounds very similar.
Oh, nice. Yeah, Slinkies. Yeah, good idea, actually. Yeah, Slinkies would be good.
Yeah, do you know, there's like, it was a cool thing I saw that it's one of the the really famous, instantly recognizable sound effects from Star Wars is like a metal slinky just stretched out like 20 feet or something like that, and you just give it a bang, and it's like,
yeah,
it's,
that's the sound of the lightsabers.
Is it the lightsabers or is it the
blasters?
It's one or the other. I can't, but it's one of the, like,
or was it it was telegraph cable, was the lightsabers telegraph cable.
Yeah, so that's right. So I think the slinky was the when they fired a shot off or whatever.
Yeah,
The blasters or whatever.
I still remember that sound. Yeah, it's great. Those sound guys, those Foley artists, are amazing. Really.
Yeah, it must be a lot of fun. And I think, like you said, like sometimes the way they come up with these things, it's got to be accidents, like just these random things. They kind of, like, what is it? What is they do? Is it like lettuce you use to get for the sound of a punch or something like that? Like, it's like really abstract a lot of the time.
Like the sound of something getting stabbed is normally a watermelon.
Yeah, yeah.
The sound of someone walking on gravel or grass is done with magnetic tape.
Wow, that's funny.
The sound of breaking glass is normally like a teaspoon in a pint glass.
Yeah, that's cool. On the Sense Ensemble Study 3, which is track 10, I have an explosion. That's all about the atomic bomb, basically.
Oh, I heard, George.
It wasn't originally about the atomic bomb.
No, the mix of stuff in there is brilliant. Yeah, I'd nearly forgotten about that. There's some really nice archived audio footage in there that really just...
Yeah, you have President Truman, who was whatever, justified the use of the atomic bomb. And then you have Hirohito, the Japanese emperor, first time on the radio, or anybody hearing him that wasn't part of his kind of set, announcing the surrender of Japan after Nagasaki or Hiroshima. Yeah. And then who else is in there? And the explosion. I just got an explosion sound. Again, actually, that was the first thing that happens, sets the levels way up.
Boom. Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. But isn't that, like, that's like something I've heard is done, like, a lot at the start of an album. Like, they like to put, like, a kind of a ear cleanser in at the start. So, like, a really kind of, like, Electric Ladyland springs to mind. You know, that first track where it's really kind of, it's all stretched and just... bits of white noise and stuff, and the idea is to kind of help clean out your ears before you get, and then you get hit with this really luscious kind of
it's a good idea.
I suppose it's a bit like a hot sauce on food. It kind of wakes up your taste buds a little bit.
I think I have a long tradition of doing additive stuff where I give you a little bit of something, put another. I like showing that, the layering, but that's the opposite approach, where you just like throw it all in there. But yeah, the Sense Ensemble 3 was originally, actually, there's a very interesting background to that. That's again track 10. That was originally not a performance with a live audience. People would come into the room, and I'd set up this kind of theater with my computer. I built this kind of frame, so it was like a curtain across my computer, and I built a little wooden platform just because it's too cheap to get a screen, so I used my computer. And I had a Pure Data. Actually, I included the Pure Data patch in there, if you want.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was like on it. Yeah. Is that
that's Max MSP?
Max, yeah. So, George, just for people who might not be familiar with Max, can you give them a little idea of what it is?
Yeah. So I'll just explain, too, so it makes more sense. Otherwise, it sounds really technical, which it's not. Basically, it was a multi-sensory composition. People, it's this really wicked phenomenon. It's called the Ledam-Shams test. You can look it up on YouTube. Look up Ledam-Shams. And it's this phenomenon where if you see two flashes and two pulses, you hear two flashes and two pulses. But what this scientist, what she did was she accompanied one flash with two pulses, two sonic pulses, doot-doot, and people would report seeing two flashes. And what she was doing was basically showing that there is a connection between what we see and what we hear, that what we hear
kind of like programmed response, like
It's more that it's cross-modal kind of cognitive processing, where what you're seeing will influence what you're hearing. You'll literally hear different things, and it actually goes to a much greater extent. She was just trying to clinically show it in that case. Yeah. But actually, there's another thing called, this is really cool, it's up on YouTube as well, the McGurk effect, and that's really wicked. This guy, they show you him saying da and ga, and then they change the audio and the video so that when he's saying da, he's actually saying ga. You hear ga, but he's with his lip saying ba, and you hear something between, which is ga. I can't remember if it's da and ba with ga in the center, that your brain basically comes up with a different solution. It's like, okay, I'm seeing his lips go buh, I'm hearing duh, so what I'm going to experience is guh. Your brain comes up with a compromise. So all the scientists were basically trying to show, look, what you see isn't just what you see, it's what you hear too. So that was my whole vibe with the album, all cross-modal.
Kind of like stirring a cup of tea. The sound kind of changes as you listen to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It reminds me a bit, George, like you probably come across like binaural tones.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's like you're presented with two different tones, like, and if they're close enough, you'll hear a kind of it's an illusion effectively, but like it is there, like it's a pulse, like it's an interaction between, and like the tones don't even necessarily have to be meeting, like if they're meeting in your ear, like in your ears, it's happening in your brain basically, which I think goes back to something you were talking about in the previous show to do with, you know, the ability to hear something also involves understanding what it is you're listening to.
Absolutely. Yeah, even if you don't truly understand the source, you need to somehow approximate or invent the solution. You just need to
understand. It's a cognitive thing then, kind of, is it, essentially? Yeah.
Absolutely. Our ears, you know, and our vision were, you know, evolved to, for survival and whatever, procreation too. And so they're tools, and I guess your bodies and your mind are desperate to understand the environment, you know, for survival, and they're always coming up with solutions, cooperative solutions. But
tastes like chicken.
Yeah. So in that sense ensemble study number 3, basically people would see flashes and pulses. And then the thing I added in, I was in contact with LaDan Shams, she's a cognitive scientist, and I can't remember where she's based in North America. But anyway, to ask her about how she got her flashes, how do you get your flashes? How do you get your cake? How do you bake that cake? But she was really helpful, and I was even in sculpting the pulses, how far apart in time I should have the pulses. But then I added in a vibrotactile element, so you had 3 things. So people would sit there watching the screen, this flash would come up, and they would write down how many flashes they saw. That was the idea. Or they'd hold their finger up. That's right. And they'd be like 1 or 2, and I'd write down.
Right.
And then I tried to study, you know, how much of a correlation there was between what they felt, what they saw, and what they heard. Whether I had 3 pulses, I had 4 pulses, I had a lot going on. And then it turned into this piece of music. I couldn't stop myself. Basically, as the pulses happened,
More
music would fill in, but they'd still see the pulses and they'd still hear those essential. So at the beginning of that study number 3, you hear this Morse code, and that's where that came from. It was the beeps, the pulses that the people were hearing while they saw the flashes. And then when it came to the album, I started adding the bits together. But it got suddenly there were so many bits. I remember I started with just 1 bit, and then I was in the kitchen one night. And I came up with, you know, it's just things just fall together. And that's the adventure. It's just like letting things happen. And again, we were talking about that with conversations, social situations, letting things happen, not trying to be in charge. And this idea of the adventure, you just have to let it happen. I think there's a lot of songwriting. You have to be there for it to happen, but you have to let it happen. You can't try to control it. And who knows where who knows where anything, you know, people say, where does the melody come from? Where does your next sentence come from? Where does your conversation come from?
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
you know,
there were things this month or, in September there that we were kind of focusing on here on Cannes. And, like going back to what you were saying, you were just working on something that you were interested in. And it turned out some of the stuff that basically we had the seed sown back in July for all of a sudden was very relevant in September. And we're like, how did that happen? We didn't plan it that way, but we were following our heart and our gut, as you said. Mm. And I think, you know, those three things together, your gut, your heart and your mind, get them balanced and go out and try and do some good work. And it does lead to, you don't know where it's going to go. And that is part of the excitement. Because once you've done it a few times, you kind of start to go, hey, this is kind of working. What happens next time?
Like, exactly. So at the beginning of that study, number three, you hear this Morse code. And that's where that came from. It was the beeps, the pulses that the people were hearing while they saw the flashes. And then I kind of took the ball and ran with it. I started thinking that's like Morse code, obviously. And I thought of when the atomic bomb went off. And the atomic bomb for me, maybe all my life, and there are a lot of things as I think an American that, you know, you have to kind of either address morally or not address them if you, that's your choice. But that one thing was the atomic bomb. I think growing up, that and still is a big thing for me. It's this idea of justifying genocide, you know, in Japan.
It can't be. Genocide, no, there's no way to justify it. Like,
yeah, I mean, and so, you know, but
that's my opinion. That's my opinion anyway. That's how I feel about
not
it.
Not even with mathematics, like.
Yeah. What'd you say?
That's not even with mathematics. One of the biggest justifications they use for Hiroshima and Nagasaki is, well, if we didn't do that, millions of other people would have died as well.
Exactly. And I think, and there's a huge part of me, I think that all my life you live in an empire, essentially the United States Empire, and you have to kind of, especially when you leave it, you live somewhere else. When I was living in Ireland, first, I've been here for 30 years now, more. But I was very conscious and self-conscious and probably insecure about that identity I had, you know, and I guess that piece of music turned into this kind of expression of that. I guess it's uncertainty, because sure, it was a war and the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and so on and so forth, but there's no getting around the mass killing is just morally unconscious. It's unconscionable, you know, whatever way you slice it. So that's what that was all about. And I enjoyed making it, probably the wrong word to use. But,
well, I have to say, George, the whole, from the first track all the way through, like it's an auditory journey. And when I started to hear that stuff coming in more towards the second half or towards the end of the album, I was like, oh, wow, more, this is great. And it was, I was like, I knew it was coming, like, towards the end of the album, I was like, I don't want this to stop. Like, this is such a journey. Like,
it's nice to hear. Thanks.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. Chris, you're gonna love it now when you get near on it.
Yeah.
So again, everybody, it's on SoundCloud. It's on SoundCloud. George Higgs, Charles, the Sense Ensemble. Check it out. So, George, just on a wee segue, we mentioned it a little bit before on the last show, and I recommend people go and check that out. But with this thing that's on screen at the moment, I'm seeing a smoke ring, and I heard a rumor that it was actually vanilla scented smoke rings you were firing out there. Is that right?
No, all the rumors are true. I made these Vortex cannons. Fancy name. Actually, I discovered them on an Amish farm in America. This guy, it was an Amish museum, basically, a museum to show Amish culture.
Wow.
This guy was in a barn, I remember, and he had a vortex cannon, but he didn't have smoke in it. He was just showing us that we could stand across the barn and hit the vortex cannon, and you'd feel that what's a donut of air. We couldn't see it, the donut, but.
Yeah. And that was my first experience with them as well, actually, was they do a thing in Circus Tripoli where they shoot cups off people's heads with them.
Exactly. Yeah. I did that with the kids. And I actually, don't ask me how I had so many beer boxes, but I had beer boxes, Miller beer, and that's when I made my first Vortex. I was like, that would be typical me. I would just, well, probably anybody, you have an idea, so I grab whatever. I taped the box tightly shut so an air could get out and cut a hole in one end and hit one side of it. It made a great Vortex can. So if you go to Little or whatever, get a Miller beer 12 pack, whatever, and make a Vortex can at home. And then you get a smoke machine and pump some smoke into it. You'll have a donut of air. So yeah, and to answer your question, I remember that was the second time around using the Vortex cannons, and I was ordering more fog fluid for the smoke machines. Actually, we have two on stage, and if you watch the video.
Yeah, we're going to get to that actually in a little bit. We'll get to the video in a little bit.
Yeah.
And make the video a more multi-sensory experience, where did they send the self-addressed envelope with the €5 in it to be sent a sample of this smoke?
To my charity.
So we got a wee bit distracted, George. You're going to tell us about this. Is this the Mac schematic here?
Did you distract me, Shane?
I might have done. Sorry.
No, I think it was me.
Terrible. Yeah, that's the Max MSP. Miller Paquette would kill me if I said that. So that's all pure data is the program I use, or Max MSP. And it's a graphical programming environment. Basically, you can drag and drop little symbols, and you can make whatever you want, actually. You can make music. You can use it for video. You can use it for all. You can turn the lights on and off in your house. Just maths, basically. And I used it to generate these pulses and these. That's just the home page. That's a little sampler. That's a sequencer, actually. You see those little steps?
Oh, wow, yeah.
That's actually the tune in the
really? Wow.
Number three, that's the tune. And actually, when you're watching the patch in real time, those little things restack. They're MIDI notes, basically. They just restack themselves. So actually, when I made the piece for the album, I had to go back into the patch, and I couldn't find the recording. I couldn't remember the tune, so I just checked the MIDI notes and wrote them down in the program and studied where they were on the piano. I was like, oh yeah, that was the tune. Yeah, so if you listen to that piece of music, it's pretty cool, because that's one of these additive things where I put, first you hear the double basses, they're just double bass samples, then a cello comes in and they're kind of bopping along, and then it's an electric piano I used instead of the sequencer. I kind of went mad on electric pianos on this album, by the way. I always loved the electric piano. I love the way that Donald Fagen uses it with Steely Dan. You know, it's like, hey, nice. They're really percussive. It's such an amazing.
Yeah, it is very percussive. Yeah.
The Rhodes or whatever they are. They're the most amazing instruments because they've got sustain. They've got percussion. Oh, they're just beautiful. And they cut through a mix. Like my salvation a couple times of the album, where it's like, what sound can I use here? I doubled a lot of instruments, actually. If you listen to Sense Ensemble 1, there's a keyboard solo in the middle. And it was originally just piano. It's quite fast. And I thought it's getting lost in the mix. So I started doubling it with different things. And I do that a lot now. I just take three instruments and I put them on top of each other. And that worked really well. I doubled it with a clavinet, with a clav, which is a really kind of throaty, raspy sound, as you know, that reggae musicians of the 70s used.
Yeah, it's so great. Well, I love it. And it's kind of got one of those, like, it's not like 100% in concert tune, which really just kind of adds to it a lot. Like,
that's a really good point. The kind of semi-pitched quality to some of those instruments.
Yeah, because the way the notes kind of crunch is a bit more unique than, like, when they, you know.
Yeah. Actually, that guy, I don't mind mentioning again, actually, where I met Larry O'Toole, the course with Dr. Dermot Furlong, DJ Furlong, he used to talk a lot about bells, the semi-pitched quality of bells, and it was all about tonality. What is a tone, you know? How do we know if it's a, you know, you have these tones like an F, and sometimes you're missing the fundamental frequency. How do we still know it's an F? You know, that's what these studies try to figure out. How's our brain? Again, it's all about the way we process reality. Now, one thing I wanted to mention before, which is really interesting, when I did that PhD about multisensory experience and the nature of how our ears affect what we see. I think what fascinated me most is when you get down to the what's called phenomenology, which I never understood what phenomenology was until, and I still don't. It's like, I repeat myself a lot, but I probably said the last time we talked.
That's okay.
It's like what...
there's only so many words, you have to repeat yourself occasionally.
Exactly. But Richard Feynman says about quantum mechanics, he says, people say they understand it. They're lying. I don't understand it. And I invented it. You know. And
that's to say, wasn't that true of the guy who invented, what was that electrical component?
Faraday or...
No, like one of the newer transistors, I think, is it?
Oh, okay, sorry.
Was it transistors? I'm not sure. But there's been a lot of stuff like that where they invented, they ended up kind of going insane trying to understand it. They just not works like, and they're like, well, I can't. Well,
electricity itself, yeah. I mean, just try to understand that. Yeah. The current goes the opposite way to what you expect it. So that stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly. But phenomenology, I didn't quite understand. And again, I still don't understand it, because how can you understand it? It's all about the nature, the essence of experience, the essence of things, you know? And I think the thing that really blows my mind is, I try to explain this to my kids. It's like we take for granted that there's this thing called reality, and we're part of, and we're experiencing reality. So we say, oh, the world is the world, and I'm looking at the world, and the information comes in my eyes, and I process it. But what the phenomenologists and embodied cognition kind of people say, theorists say, is that no, the reality is this participative, this interaction that we transact with what there are things around us, surely, but they're not just there. We're creating them as much as they exist. So this cup, you know, I see this cup as a cup because I have spent my whole life and my grandfather, grandmother, the evolution of my body has created this kind of way of interacting with the things around me. And I see it as a cup only because I've been conditioned that way. And there's so much history. There's so much history to the experience of this cup. And I probably people hear that like, yeah, whatever.
It's just a cup. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but it's really
no. But you know, I used to do a thing every now and then where, like, someone would offer me a cup of tea, and I go, "No, I'll have a bowl of tea, please." and they'd be like, "What?" It's like, "Oh, can I have it in a bowl, please?"
Yeah,
they'd be like, "You can't have tea in a bowl. You put tea in a cup."
Exactly. You know? It's funny. It's funny you changed the words. I think it's really good. That's a really good point. It's like, again, about this multisensory experience. Again, just to cut it back, it's like, is music multisensory? It depends how you decide to think about it. And if you start thinking about it that way, it changes lots of things. If you think about it as a bowl, you know, drink your, what's the difference? Drink, the French drink their coffee out of a bowl. It changes the experience, you know? But we often say that about food. I mean, which is sure everybody will agree. The texture of food hugely influences your experience.
Yeah, or what you expect to taste when you see it as well. Who was that, Chris?
And the temperature and...
Chris, wasn't there some famous contemporary artist you mentioned to me there a while back who does some kind of weird things where he makes food that, like, it looks like a burger, but it tastes like ice cream or cake or something it was almost an experiment, like, a study, probably another study, like George is talking about, like
he did a breakfast, right? And like the yolk was mango pureed and mixed with gelatin, the white was vanilla flavored, like it wasn't an egg,
right.
It was kind of set jelly,
like a Cadbury's
partly vanilla, partly mango.
That's funny.
The tomato was white pudding wrapped in like a sauce that had been congealed down, like using gelling agents.
That's gas.
And then wrapped around the pudding to make a tomato.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking thing. And, you know, there was a few different things. Like nothing tasted or was like it looked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And nice. It really confused people.
It's a bit like that thing, you know, like that came out there years back. It was like how it was all the trend to have your caviar with white chocolate, like, you know. It's like, I wouldn't eat, I wouldn't be into caviar myself anyway. But when you think, like, caviar and white chocolate, how would that ever work? But apparently it does, like, so there's weird things like that. But listen, we're going to take another wee bumper break, and I just want to let people know again before I let you know where to find George's album about that program, Max or Pure Data, Max DSP or Pure Data, is that correct, George?
Yeah.
And DSP stands for Digital Signal Processing, and that's open source, George, I think, isn't it, as far as I know?
Pure Data is open source. Max MSP by.
Yeah, so I can't find the graph there, but that was that kind of schematic thing. Oops. So just for anybody who might be interested in that, or people who are interested in MIDI in general, like Pure Data, and they weren't teaching that when I was still in college. It's something I'd love to go and look at, because there's been times when I've been working with MIDI where I just needed to do something that just wasn't quite available in a VST plugin, and Pure Data would have been a way to go about it. And it's something you can probably study yourself, George, is it? It's
entirely.
Not
my my recommendation with it is download PD and follow some of the tutorials, and this is what I'd say: use it for something you need to use, just do something simple like to play a sound, and it's surprisingly easy at first. People like sort of mind-boggling for them, but it's
yeah.
good.
And then you can do all kinds of stuff with it, because you could either link it with MIDI, or I've seen people linking it with this thing, Arduino. Do you know those Arduino
Absolutely
things?
Yeah.
And to do all kinds of incredible stuff. And then the other thing is then if you get into the mobile app kind of territory, there's also
exactly.
Yeah, so it would be quite useful. So I'll roll the bumper. And what do you reckon, George? We come back, will we watch a bit of the performance when we get back?
Yeah, and I'll just, one thing I want to make sure I talk about is the expression sense ensemble, and I just sent you some pictures you can take a look to talk about that, because again it ties in with this whole idea why I call it sense ensemble in the first place.
Right, and you know, we've got lots of time today, so we're gonna go for as long as we can, and hopefully there won't be any power cuts in the middle of this storm, but so let's just see. And before I roll the bumper, I'm gonna hit stop. Let's hold our breath.